the worst of California's criminal offenders get sent here.
Why do you think you deserve a second chance when you're a victim then? I told Commissioner, the person that was arrested, came into prison, does not deserve a second chance. But I told him, I'm not that person anymore. I was born in Vietnam. In California, where we moved to, where I am currently now, is the largest Vietnamese diaspora outside of Vietnam. That was also the time in my life where my older brother started to get involved with gangs.
Tell me about what happened the night that you got in trouble. They say your sentence is life in prison, no option for parole.
Yes.
How do you get through that?
We saw a flyer on the wall. It say dog program. And at that time, like, people think it's a joke because people do joke like that.
How did that program change your life?
It gave me a lot of self-worth because I didn't have any. When I'm starting working with this animal and connecting with this animal, all those emotions about who I am as a person, like what is my role are, like what is life about, all those come surface.
God, your story is, there were so many times I had to not cry. I'm so proud of you. Welcome back to Misunderstood. Okay, guys, stop and hear me out for a second. This is one of my best episodes in terms of I had to hold back tears when I listened to this guy's story. It was so incredible. It was so, I'm having a hard time obviously speaking words because it was so over the top in terms of something that you just can't believe that happened, and also the transformation that it gave. And this is why I have this show. This is a show based on second chances. It's a show based on people who have been reduced to a headline and they're on a mission to change their narrative. This guy is just that. So, and everything I do is about people that deserve to be heard out, but also about dogs, if you know anything about me. So this incorporates both. But today we have the privilege of welcoming an extraordinary guest whose story is a testament to resilience, transformation, and the boundless potential for what I said before, second chances. Newt Vo was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole at just 16 years old. You're going to hear the whole story. It's incredible. Despite facing what seemed like insurmountable odds, Newt turned his life around, embracing self-growth and transformation while incarcerated. After being granted his freedom, he has committed himself to making a positive impact in the world. This happened because while he was in prison, he was accepted into a program called Positive Change. He's now a proud part continuously of Positive Change. It's a unique and life-changing initiative that bridges two worlds often overlooked, rescue dogs and incarcerated individuals, giving these dogs a second chance to find loving homes while providing inmates with the skills, compassion, and purpose needed for their own rehabilitation. By the way, these dogs also are all on the euthanasia list because they have behavioral problems. So it's taking these dogs that really no one wants to deal with and pairing them with inmates and finding this synergy to really rehabilitate both of them. The program not only transforms the lives of the dogs, but also helps inmates develop responsibility, empathy, and the tools to reintegrate into society as contributing members. Newt's incredible journey from a life sentence to becoming an advocate for change and a mentor to both people and animals is truly inspiring. His work amplifies how compassion and second chances can make a profound difference. Please join me in welcoming Newt Vo as we hear his powerful story and the transformative impact of the Positive Change program. Newt, it is my honor to meet you and to have you on my show today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So I just want to let you know that I literally started this podcast and have this platform for people that have stories like you. I am so excited to be able to have our listeners hear how you got here from where you were in your past. And you are so deserving of a second chance. So I wanted to start with that and tell you that. But I'm so excited for everyone to hear this story. So Let's begin at the beginning, because the end is obviously the exciting part and all the things you're doing now are so interesting. But I want everyone to hear how you got here. Can you explain kind of where you were when you were younger, the kind of lifestyle you had, the childhood you had, your parents who raised us? Give us a little bit of like lay the land for us.
So I was born in Vietnam in the 1980. When I was born, my father had left the country shortly after the war. So I didn't know who my father was. My mother was pregnant with me. And I was born in a rural area in southern Vietnam. And it's an idyllic lifestyle. You know, there's rice field there, water buffalo. And it's a thing of beauty for me every time I think of it. There wasn't that much care, concern about life. We grow our own food. We eat our own food. We fish for our own food. So I lived with my grandparent at that time, with my mother and two older siblings. Shortly after we moved into the city, when we learned our father had made it to the United States, and I think about 6 or 7 years later, we start getting correspondence from him. Before then, we didn't know what happened to him. Mm-hmm. And so we moved to a more inner city in Vietnam with my uncle on my maternal side, my mother's side. And it's different from the village. There's this hustle and bustle environment where there's a street market. And the disparity between the have and have not is very clear. And I think that's where I first had this notion of what that is. So we were the have not. We didn't have that much. We were living in a shack with my grandmother, my uncle, his family. He have two daughters. And shortly after that, we learned that, our father become a U.S. citizen. And now we are becoming a potential sponsor to come to America. And that just really changed, everyone's perspective. I didn't know what that really mean, but I do know that people started treating us differently. That like it's almost like you win a golden ticket to Willy Wonka. it kind of, the feeling is the same. Everybody look at you that way. You just don't know because you're right in the middle of it. Wow. I feel I was a very insecure, timid kid, I would say introvert. I like spend time by myself. I like going to the right field, catching betta fish, doing simple thing like that. I'm not comfortable socializing with other youth, the kid. And so I make a lot of assumption about the world, but the only validation is my own judgment of what the world is. I don't get feedback from outside. So I have, later on, I realized I have a very distorted way of seeing things. But that's what started out for me. And I was very excited. I'm going to get to meet my father for the first time. When you are in Vietnam, it's a very socially family-oriented culture. So to be in a family without a father, there's a saying in Vietnamese, they say, không có cha, có nghĩa nhà không có nóc. It means without a father is like a house without a roof. Like wow. Fall in, and it's a social disdain, I think. I know my mother carried a lot of that. I didn't really know what that was, but I have a sense of it. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's like me and my father coming to America. Everything is restored. Everything, all the problem, all the thing that I feel insecure about. It's going to be restored. That's my mindset.
Wow.
And so we were sponsored when I was 9. I think it was 78. Yeah, no, I'm off with the time. Anyway, when we came to America, I think it was 98 when we come here. I was 9 years old. I met my father for the first time, and I have heard a lot about him, and it's a strange feeling. It's like, you know, you've seen this person, and you know, you long to see this person, but I just like, it didn't really register for me.
Mm-hmm. And what state did you go to? Where did he live?
We moved to California. So it's interesting because in California, where we moved to, where I am currently now, is the largest Vietnamese diaspora outside of Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
In the world. So here is like the little Saigon, right? This is the capital of the diaspora of all of Vietnamese. So we go right into the center of that.
And who did you move with? Your mom came and your siblings? Mother,
my two older brother, just us.
And did you end up, and you lived with your dad? It was the first time your mom and your dad were reunited, or you just lived in the same area?
We lived with our dad in an apartment.
Okay.
So I had this idea that America is like, it's like heaven. The way people describe America in Vietnam was everybody leave their door open because everybody have a refrigerator. Everybody have, a microwave, which is true. But, you know, microwave refrigerator is only reserved for very rich people in Vietnam and TV. In America, everybody have it and the door is wide open because nobody going to take stuff from people because everybody have the same thing. And then, you know, of course, I learned later on that's true, but not necessarily true.
Right.
And we are considered a have not still when I came here. And so I internalize a lot of these things. I don't really share that with anyone. It's just, I think a lot, the way I see things, it's how I measure my self-worth in a way. I didn't really realize this until later on down the line.
Sure.
When I start to grow up and do a lot more introspection. But at that time, I view myself as very inferior because of the life setting, because of circumstances of my life. And a lot of it is my own inability to investigate, to engage, and to socialize, to learn that, you know, maybe my thought about myself is not true. And right. I don't have adult in my life to praise me or to tell me, you know, you are more than that.
So was your dad and mom kind to you when you came here, or you kind of were left to hang out with the new people in your life and the classmates and the kids in the street?
They were very kind. They are very kind, very moral, disciplined people. But the sad thing is they have to work.
Got it.
And so I don't get to see them. The only time I see my father was when I started to misbehave. And of course, when I see him, he's upset. He's like, right. You know, why am I have to see you? Why do I have to see you? And to me, that's the only time that I get their attention is when I misbehave. And it's just unfortunate, but that was, you know, that was the life circumstances that we had. They had to work. They had to make sure that we are provided for.
Right. So did you, I'm just curious, because I know animals have become a big part of your life. Did you guys have a dog when you were younger?
No, we have a very different association with dog in Vietnam. They just stray. They do their thing. We do our thing. I was actually scared of dog my whole life. I was told they have rabies. Like, so I have a very negative outlook about dogs. So I was never really interact with them. I remember. I probably have been at one point when I was a kid, but that's probably contributed to why I'm afraid of them.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So now tell me, because eventually there's a problem and it sounds like you got with the wrong crowd. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So, as I live in America and I started to figure out what America is, I started to feel the same feeling I have when I was in Vietnam. I just feel like I didn't belong. I feel like I didn't have any support. I feel like I'm not belonging to any community. And this is a culture. There's a culture conflict that I was observing, and I didn't know what to make of it. So traditionally, Asian and Vietnamese people are very family oriented. You know your role, and you behave within the confine of your role. You don't go outside of that. I was the youngest child, so I just obey and listen. I don't question. I don't ask why. And then when I go to school and I see American children who have a lot of liberty, have a lot of right. What is one strange thing that always stood out to me is some of the children say that my parents have to knock on the door before they can come in. And that was just I couldn't imagine that.
It was like a foreign concept to you.
Yes. So I can't imagine my parents have to request for my approval to come into my room. That just, outrageous to me. But it just, just the idea of me being in the middle of two different cultures, and I'm a child, so I'm growing up in both. So I started to develop a little rebellion towards that. Like, this is how things are. And my parents, of course, do not understand the culture. They just work. And then the role sometimes empower me to, I find myself in role of a translator, for instance. So it reduces my parent authority over me. And I, as a child, I took advantage of that. I look at that as something that's empowering. And so I started losing respect for them in that context. So I get to be the person that tell them what these people are saying, and this is what it's about. And so when they come and they have to ask for my advice, being a child, I didn't really appreciate the beauty of that. I took advantage of it.
Got it.
But that was the conflict I was having. And I also have conflict in school, being a shy and insecure kid. I get into fight, I get bullied, and for the more part, I just take it. I just thought that what how it should be. But then some kid, they can gear their energy toward education and focus on that. I didn't have that. I have a lot of self-limiting beliefs, so I didn't think I was good in school. I didn't comprehend what was being taught to me. And so I'm just kind of stuck and not having any sense of direction. That was also the time in my life where my older brother is starting to get involved with gangs. So I'm being exposed to a whole different group of people who experienced similar thing that I did, but thought they found a solution, which
Got
is
it.
Giving up and acting out and just basically, try to have some type of control of their life by
right.
doing.
And not only that, I would assume that being part of a gang meant all of a sudden you were part of something. You had some friends that backed you up. It became your kind of somewhat of a family.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So you got involved in a gang.
Yes.
And was it the same one that your brothers did?
Yes.
Okay. So can you talk? So when you got arrested, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but had you ever had any problems with the law up until that time?
No, not. Yes, I have problem, but I was never incarcerated. So I get arrested for hanging out with my gang friend. And of course, being youth underage, for instance, being out of curfew.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just like more on the innocent side of troublemaking and a young kid getting involved in some junk,
but not
stealing, not beating people up, not any significant charges.
But I was heading in that direction.
Got it. And had your brothers at this point been incarcerated for anything?
Yes.
Okay. So they started to get in some real trouble.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Will you tell me about what happened the night that you got in trouble or day, whatever it was?
Yeah, it's what evening is about from 5 to 7, I believe, p.m. We went to a party, a after graduation school party. So all these are teenagers.
And you were how old?
I was 16 at the time.
So you had been in America about 7 years?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I went to this party with a group of my gang friends. When we arrive at this party, we encounter a rival gang. And one of my friend was assaulted a couple weeks ago from this particular gang. When we arrive at the party, I now have a very idea of myself. Mm-hmm. I am a gang member and I like the attention. I like the affirmation. I, like you mentioned, I feel like I'm part of a family and I am a representative of this family. And so when that was the mindset that I have.
Right. Like these are my brothers. If somebody fucks with them, they fuck with me. That whole mindset.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I came to this party and when I learned that the rival was there, we had a confrontation. When I saw them in the backyard, I come and I asked them which one of them were the one that assaulted my friend a couple of weeks ago. And of course, they have the same mindset that I do. They go, I did. You know, like, who are you asking? And so it escalated. it escalated. And while it was escalating, one of the member from the rival gang were actually, I consider him cousin because we come to America together. We were in Thailand together, but we.
So you had some real history with this guy who happened to be on the other in the other gang.
Yes.
Okay.
And so he came. He asked me what's going on, and I explained to him what's going on. He's like, you know, just let it go. It's a party, you know. Like I can assure everything is fine. And at that moment, in my mindset, I felt like I did what I needed to do. The attention was on me. Everybody like, oh yeah, you know, Nhuc did that. That's who he is. There was girl there. I got the attention from the girl. I realized later on, it's not so much about my friend. Standing up for my friend is really standing up for me. Mm. I was that selfish. I just wanted that attention. And I say, sure, but the rival gang didn't want it to back down. It's like, no, we, and so, as we were talking, my cousin, the person I told you that was just like family to me, reached out like, let's just squash this. So he reached his hand out and I shook his hand. And my gang friend at that time would not accept that. And when this actually happened, he pulled out a gun and shot the person facing me.
Your cousin?
Not my cousin.
Someone else.
The person I was talking to. And he was a juvenile. I think he was 14 or 15 and was pronounced dead on the scene.
Wow. So someone from your gang shot the other gang member and he was pronounced dead.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the second person gets shot. Two person was dead on the scene.
Wow.
Another person was shot in the back and was paralyzed from the waist down.
Wow.
Another person got shot and he recovered, but I can assure you he suffered trauma. Everyone suffered trauma to that ordeal.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Of course. So the person that was it only one person that was doing the shooting, or a bunch of people started grabbing guns and shooting each other?
Just one person.
One person. And what happened to that guy, by the way?
He's currently incarcerated.
He is. Okay. So the police show up, and what happens?
The police show up, and a couple of days later, 2 days later, they came to my house, asked me to come in to interview, asked me what happened. And I told them exactly what happened. I told them how it played out, although I told them that I was trying to make peace. Mm-hmm. I was a person that trying to make peace, which I did at the end, mm-hmm. but that was not my intention at the beginning.
Right. I'm curious, going into that night, do you think that the person that pulled out the gun, do you think it was his intention to get into an argument and to shoot someone, or you think it just escalated and that's what happened?
I think now that I know the mindset of youth, because I have been part of my job now is I go into juvenile hall, I talk to the youth, and I myself was a youth. Sometimes youths are incapable of planning that far ahead. They are very impulsive. And what I believe happened at that moment, it just thing escalated. And the person at that time feel as if that he's going to lose everything if he's going to walk away from this.
Got it.
And so that's why he did what he did, rather than he planning to go over there. And of course, that's just my assumption of what his mind meant. That's how it was for me. I didn't plan to go over there and be involved in something at detrimental at this. And so, yes, I don't believe that he had the intention to kill him.
I finally discovered my sleep superhero with Dreamies. These gummies are like a cozy hug for my body and mind, getting me ready for a night of rejuvenation. Seriously, I wake up feeling like I can conquer the world. I've had a really hard time with my sleep cycles for years. I've tried prescription drugs. I've tried the melatonin and the things over the counter. Nothing really works for me. So the mix in Dreamies of melatonin and ashwagandha is a game changer for my racing thoughts. It's like hitting the off switch for my brain. And let's not forget magnesium. It's my go-to for easing those perky tensions after a long day of juggling work, family, and life. I love how Dreamies helps keep my melatonin levels in check. As I navigate this busy phase of life, it's comforting to know I have a little helper looking out for my well-being. Plus, I've noticed that catching enough Z's makes a big difference for my weight management. When I'm well-rested, I'm way more likely to choose that salad over the cookie, most of the time at least. Go to holisticgoddess.com and check out Dreamies. Get 15% off by using code UNDERSTOOD. Again, that's holisticgoddess.com with code UNDERSTOOD for 15% off. Hey, Misunderstood listeners, this episode is brought to you by LolaVie. Yes, the award-winning hair care line founded by none other than Jennifer Aniston herself. With the holiday season upon us, it's the perfect time to embrace the joy of giving. And let's be honest, what could be better than the gift of gorgeous, healthy hair? Jen created LolaVie because she, like so many of us, was tired of choosing between hair care products that actually worked and ones that were good for us. So she set out to create the ultimate clean, plant-powered hair care line. Whether your hair is curly, straight, fine, or thick, LolaVie has something for everyone. The secret sauce? Their B Pro 3 Bond technology, derived from chia seeds. It's clinically proven to repair, protect, and prevent signs of damage and aging in your hair. It doesn't just mask the problem, it combats dry and breakage at the source, giving you visibly stronger, healthier hair. Now, let me tell you about my experience. I've been using the Ultimate Care Kit, and it's been a game changer for my hair. The restorative shampoo and conditioner made my hair feel softer and healthier after just one wash. And the glossing detangler, wow, it is my go-to for battling frizz, protecting my hair from heat styling, and adding that salon-worthy shine. If you're looking for the perfect gift this season, definitely check out that Ultimate Care gift. So this holiday season, unlock Jennifer Aniston approved hair at LolaVie.com. As a listener of this show, you'll get an exclusive 15% off your entire order when you use the code Rachel15 at checkout. That's LolaVie.com with promo code Rachel15. So I'm curious, at this point, when you were able to go home for 2 days until the police came to see you, in the mindset of somebody in a gang, would this mean that you guys are talking and thinking, oh, now we have to get back at someone? Or you thought that other gang was saying, oh, we've got to get back at them because they shot our guys? I mean, is that going on in between you having to have a conversation with the police?
Yeah, I'm sure some of that go on. Now that is, of course, the other gang going to retaliate. Mm-hmm. And then we have this thing pending that we're going to get arrested for this. I was naive enough to think that I didn't do anything wrong. That was my attitude the whole time. Mm-hmm. I didn't do anything wrong. If anything, what I did was I started an argument. Right. That's what I was thinking. Of course, that wasn't the case. So I did not, after I gave my interview, I would release, and I just move on with my life. My parents were so afraid, because what happened was on the news. It's probably one of the most violent gang case in Orange County at that time.
Wow.
And my parents sent me back to Vietnam. They sent me back to Vietnam. I remember the conversation I had with my dad. He's like, you need to realize what you have that million of people in Vietnam do not have. The opportunity to come to this country, opportunity for education, the opportunity for American dream, and this is what you do with it. I remember it was a very hard conversation. I sent a lot of emotion from him for the first time that I ever had a conversation with him. And
wow. He was disappointed in you, clearly.
Very disappointed, yeah.
So you get sent back to Vietnam. And so how long were you there? How did you end up coming back here? What happened?
I was over there for a few months, and you know, I convinced them that I want to change my life. I understand now, because yes, Vietnam is a terrible place. I mean, there are people that live on a day or two, a dollar or $2 a day, and it's just, you know, they live in disparity. And I believe that to be true. And of course, when I came back to America, I was still that kid that want to do bad thing, but I wasn't as involved with the gang as I used to be before.
Okay. So, and how does that work with gangs? Like, if you want to kind of separate yourselves from them, is it hard to, or are they like, oh, you're being a pussy? Like, how does that work?
Well, there's two pressure that come from that. One is pressure from the gang, and two is the self pressure. Okay. So if you realize, if you truly believe, which I have, that I was part of this family, this gang, being disowned by your family is very hard to accept. Mm. So you always try to find your way back in, prove that you are worthy of the gang member. So that's the internal pressure that you have. And then the external pressure is, yes, if you do encounter this gang member and you are not acting or the way that you're supposed to be acting, and there are repercussions for that. So what happened for me, when I came back, I moved to another state. I went into trade college. I go to work. I was doing different job.
Really?
I was actually living in Florida at the time, and I was working until I came back here to visit my family 3 years later, and I was pulled over and they told me I have a search warrant for double homicide. So the whole period, there was no indictment filed on me. There was on me.
And so when you were finally arrested, you were over 18.
I was 19.
So do you think that's what had something to do with the sentence you end up getting? Because it happened when you were a child. Doesn't that consider you're a child because you're 16? And then if you're arrested after 18, then you go into a different court? I mean, is that what happens?
I mean, so what happened in California, at that time, they have a law that they can transfer so the prosecutor can file a adult indictment for a youth offender, and the court can accept that or not. So you can be a child and they can persecute you as an adult, which is what they did for me.
Okay.
A lot of those things now starting to change. There's a lot of new law that help juvenile. But in my case, I would charge as an adult for a juvenile crime.
Got it. So up until then, by the way, who else had been arrested?
Two of my friends that was present there got arrested. One got arrested and released shortly after. The other one got arrested and he went to trial and he lost trial and he was sentenced to like 38 years to life.
And where is he now?
He's still incarcerated.
Oh, wow. Okay. And then the other guy was the guy who had the gun.
He got arrested later and he actually took a plea bargain for a life without sentence.
Life without parole.
Yes.
And he's still serving that.
Yes.
And when you take, I'm just curious, when you take a sentence like that or a plea deal like that, he can't appeal that? Like, can he ever get out on parole or that he's done?
Unless the law changes. He can file for a commutation with the governor. Unless the law changes that, because right now in California and other states, they have adopted a law which benefit me was if you were a juvenile at the time you were sent to life without possibility of parole, they have to take you back to court and give you a hearing where they have to determine the psychological development or factor of youth in consideration should you get an opportunity to earn parole or not.
Right.
That's the new law. If they extend the law, because so at that time, all my co-defendants are older than me. I was 16-year-old. They're all in their 20s.
Got it. Oh, okay, fine. So they were adults anyway.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. So just briefly, tell me what that was like, the process of they pick you up, they arrest you. How long was it? I mean, did you have a trial? How long was it until they finally said to you, okay, you're getting life without parole?
It took about, I think, 2.5 years fighting my case. So when I was first arrested, I can't remember the first time I ever came into the system. I got in trouble when, like I shared with you, had to use, but I just, you know, I would never recommend it for it. Mm-hmm. I think I was, it's even up to 2 years when I was going to trial, I still didn't believe it was happening. Mm-hmm. I was just in this like shock moment that the extension of the initial shock just keep going because I just couldn't. And I think a lot of it is me telling myself I didn't do anything wrong. So I would play this victim role in my mind, like I was a victim here. Why am I being persecuted? But then there's the other half of me. Right when you come into the county jail with a sentence that I have, there's a lot of expectation from incarcerated people, incarcerated population. And I took advantage of that.
Meaning what?
Well, if you come in for a theft or a drug case, people don't, they look at you with a half eye. Like they don't, you nobody. If you come in and you come in for a murder case, it's different. But they will challenge you. Sorry about that.
That's okay. So even though you had not pulled the trigger, you were considered someone that was there for murder. So what, it gave you a little clout or something?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. You come in as a gang member is different than you coming in not as a gang member. And you
okay,
come
so
in.
So that was working somewhat in your favor.
Yes.
And the gang that you're a part of, was there a segment of that in jail? So all of a sudden you had this family in jail with you?
No, I didn't have any friend in my gang, but I have run to people that know me in the gang.
Okay.
So before I even came in there, I built a reputation for myself at being someone that are part of a gang that live the gang lifestyle. So when I come in there, I have to uphold that identity. You have to get into fight. People will come borrow stuff from you and not expecting to give it back. And you have to be ready to ask for that back. Or you have to be ready. Your safety is proportional to your reputation.
Got it.
That's how.
And then you have to continue that reputation by living up to it the whole time. Yeah. Okay, so you're eventually told, did you take a plea deal or you lost a trial?
I lost a trial. My plea deal was for 50 years to life.
Okay.
And it's, yeah.
And your lawyers thought that that was a terrible idea.
I have I have so much trouble with lawyers. As in my family, they don't speak English. So when I came in, they just pulled all their savings, trying to find me an attorney. And they found me someone that a lawyer for like traffic. No history of
a murder
case. And this person, so I came, I didn't know anything either. I mean, I came in with very little English. You know, a lot of the English that I have learned is through my incarceration. So I live like in a very ethnic isolated community.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the lawyer just keep stringing my family along, getting their money and saying that he worked out deal, but that's what the deal he came back with is 50 years to life. And a lot of people later on look at my case, felt like I should not even gotten the sentence that I have.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So you ended up losing a trial. And what do they say to you? They say your sentence is life in prison, no option for parole.
Yes.
And that's what you're given.
The judge, when he sentenced me, he said he don't have a choice. This is in the transcript. He say, I do not have a choice. He say that it clearly you were a kid at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm.
But the law required me to sentence you to life without possibility of parole for the purpose of deterring others.
So you were a lesson to other people. Oh my gosh. Nick, this is a terrible story. Okay. So let's fast forward a little bit. You're in jail. I mean, I would love to hear all the details about what those first couple of days were like, but so that we can move this story along and I don't start crying, I want to hear a little bit, just give me the overview of what it was like for that first 10, 15 years when you did not think there was another option. Did your parents visit you? Did you make friends? Were you living in fear? Were you having the best time? What was it like?
I was afraid. I mean, it's hard for me to admit that at that time, but now, you know, I'm an adult. I have lived experience. And I can genuinely and honestly say I was afraid. I was really afraid. I was a small guy. And I wasn't as tough as I make myself out to be. I mean, what I remember my experience of my early prison term is I have to constantly convince myself that I can do this. It's something that I have to constantly put effort in. It wasn't natural for me. It may appear natural on the appearance, but internally it wasn't natural for me.
You were acting. You had to be a tough guy because that's who people thought you were.
Yes.
And how often do you think you were getting into physical altercations where you were actually physically having to hurt someone or getting hurt?
I mean, the first cellmate I had when I came to prison, we got into a fight. And it's escalated because it's just an act of affirming my role that I fit in this environment, I fit in this culture, and it's just establishing myself. So that's something that I learned my lesson from the beginning. I allow certain things to go, and it escalated. Sink in for me was a lot of story that I heard while I was in a county jail. A lot of older guy in Canada County Jail tell me, you come to prison with a life without sentence, this is what you got to do. The first thing you need to do is you need to go to the hole. I didn't know, you know, you have to go to segregation confinement, which is when you get in trouble, you go to the hole. You go to the hole, that go on your jacket. This is the person, and you need to go to the hole for violence. Not for anything else, but for violence. So that's the first thing you need to do. And when you go to a hole, they do a roll call. You go in there, hey, who are you? They have what they call a 14D, which is a write-up document. Mm-hmm. It'll say why you're in the hole. And if you go in the hole for violence, you get received very, welcomely, right? If you're in the hole for any other purpose, then you just get sunk. Nobody talked to you. It's my life story again. I just want to be accepted. I don't like to be sung. I don't like to feel like I'm a nobody. And so, I think just 3 months into my prison term, I got into a fight with my cellmate. And then after that, I went to hold 3 times during my, I have 1 shoe term, 2 whole time during my, and many other fight that wasn't, I didn't get in trouble for. But yeah.
Hey there, misunderstood listeners. Let's face it, aging is a fact of life. But how we age, that's entirely up to us. And that's why I'm excited to tell you about Renew Youth. For over 25 years, they've been leaders in hormone therapy and longevity medicine, helping people age better with personalized solutions. No cookie cutter plans here. They create treatments tailored specifically to you. Their comprehensive approach includes testosterone replacement and estrogen control for men, hormone balancing for women, and so much more. Plus, they go beyond hormones, offering support for weight loss, sexual health, nutrition, and overall well-being. Best of all, every treatment is physician supervised, so you know it's both safe and effective. And here's something inspiring. Renew Youth has clients who've been with them since 1999. Talk about trust and long-term results. Now for the best part, my listeners can get an exclusive offer, save 50% off on your initial lab testing by visiting renewyouth.com/misunderstood. That's renewyouth.com/MISUNDERSTOOD. Don't wait, for your free consultation is just a click away. Take control of how you age with Renew Youth, because a better you starts today. And when you say you go into, it's like solitary confinement. Is that what we see in the movies where it's like no one's in there? It's black. You don't get out.
Yeah, well, you get, you have light in there, but they have a window, but the window is to another wall. It's funny.
Oh my gosh.
You look out the window, you see a wall. And you know, it's concrete bed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything is concrete. And
oh, they don't have a mattress on it?
Oh, they'll give you a mattress.
Oh, okay.
It's a concrete, you know, a bed. So you, they do give you a mattress to put on top of that. Yeah.
Okay. And what do you remember from being in solitary confinement like that? Like, was it cold? Was it silent? Was it boring? What, how do you get through that?
All of it. I think the thing that I noticed most about solitary confinement is how uncomfortable silent is. Silent have a sound, and it's very noisy. it's like an eerie sound, and it's not real. But you know, then you question yourself: is this external or internal? Is it my own head telling me there's this sound, or is this really this sound? And then once in a while, you hear like a pin drop or an officer walking. Until this day, I can't get over the sound of the footstep and key. It's like when I hear it, my body respond to it. But that's the first thing I noticed, is that I hate silent. I was really afraid of it, and I used to think I was an introvert. Like, I'm comfortable being in myself, but I'm comfortable being in myself in open space, not in a confined space. It's very, it's a scary feeling.
You said your body, you have a physical reaction when you hear keys and footsteps, because that made you excited that you were going to interact with someone, or because that scared you?
It's both. It's like a nervous, anxious energy that you get. It's almost like anticipation, something going to happen.
Right.
You don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, if put your body in alert, that's right. It's almost like a pre-post-trauma type of response.
Right. And for anyone that is, I'm curious about the mindset of someone who thinks they're in prison forever with no option to get out. Do you still hold out hope? Do you still try and reach out to people on the outside world? Or do you just say, okay, these are my friends, this is my life, I'm done? Like, how do you get through that?
So that part of my playing actor role, right? So secretly, I would write my family. I would try to reach out to attorneys. Secretly, I still work on my case. I want to work on my case. That's when I start learning English. I actually learned to read a penal code. How to decipher cases. These are the things that I learned, because what I remember most is when I sit in that courtroom, and I know everyone was talking about me, but I'm no different than a fly on the wall. I have no say-so. I do not understand what they were saying. They're using legal jargon that I do. I mean, I remember the word. I have to go back and look up in the dictionary. The word was stipulation. I didn't know what that word mean. But apparently my attorney and the prosecutor agreed to something that I have no idea what it was. So this word keep coming up, but I have to learn. I have to learn in order to survive. But I don't outwardly tell the guy that, hey, I'm trying to learn these things. Mm-hmm. I'm here. I'm committed to being here. And this is all life. And I am a factor in this culture. But secretly, yes, I still held on to that hope that I can find way to appeal my case, find way to go home.
And in prison, did you feel given up on, or are there, I mean, listen, you are so well-spoken and you are very in tune with yourself and other people. So you must, and you said you went in there not speaking terribly, you know, English terribly well. So you obviously learned a lot. Did they give that opportunity to you, or you took it and you figured it out? Like how did you become the person you are now?
Sadly, when you sent into life without a possibility of parole, you are excluded from educational program. Okay. Only people with a determinate sentence is a priority to go get their GED to be involved in education. Life without possibility of parole are not exclusively banned from it, but they're just way down at the list. And they're in a prison setting. If you have life without, you can't go outside the perimeter. Education and other program are always outside of the perimeter. So just based on policy alone, you can't even go outside of that. And I have to stay on the maximum security prison despite of how, so they have a point system. When you behave well every year, they take up 8 points. And the lower your point, the lower the custody level you have. For life without, back in those days, which changed now, regardless, if you hit a 0 point, you still have to stay on maximum prison on a level 4 prison in California. So that's no incentive for anyone to try to do better. I mean, right. You're just destined to die here in this space.
You're just surviving. Most people at that point are just surviving.
Well, I learned, I read book. I learned how to read. I figure things out. I try to figure things out on my own. And there are elder prisoner incarcerated people at the time that were kind enough to show, hey, focus on this. This what going to get you out. This is the type of knowledge you need, and stay away from that. And of course, I listen to what they're saying, but outwardly, I don't show that. Okay, yeah, I'm taking what you, because I'm too afraid of being different right now. I need to be the same as everyone else.
Right, right. And you didn't want to show that you had hope that your life could change and you can get out of there. Okay, so at some point, and explain to our listeners, how long were you in there when all of a sudden you were given hope that your sentence was changed slightly?
I was in there for 15 years. The first time I have heard of this, well, real hope came to me when I was in solitary confinement. I was at Salina Valley State Prison. I received a letter from Elizabeth Calvin. She is a person, she's an attorney for the Human Rights Watch, an organization that that helped prisoners at that time, particularly juvenile. And I received a letter from her, and she said that the United States Supreme Court just made a ruling that is cruel and unusual punishment to sentence a child to die in prison. And you qualify for this. And this is the first time I ever, you know, my name is associated with the word qualify. It's like throughout the appeal process, I get denied. And so I was afraid. I mean, I held on to that piece of paper. I looked at it like several times throughout the night just to reaffirm if this is true or not. And then I remember there was like a burst of guilt and shame that come up when I realized I was in a hole at the moment. I'm being reprimanded. If this law change is changed for people that go into college, people that will make real effort. And I just have so much negative feel about myself at that time. Like, I don't feel like I deserve that. So I exclude myself from that. That was my thought. But that's what the real hope, you know, right. something right. that's tangible.
Yeah. So what was that? So how did it, your sentence actually change when you finally heard?
So
what did it become? It became life in prison with the possibility of parole now. Is that what the words were?
Yes. So they took me back to court and they resentenced me. But when I went back to court, something else happened. When I went back to court, the Innocent Project reached out to me. They worked with my case. And they say that there's a new law that just passed that if you are not the actual perpetrator, you should not get life without possibility of parole. And you shouldn't even get life in prison. You should just get the minimum count, which is, I think, a battery, assault and battery. Mm-hmm. But that's what happened. So when they took me back to court, this group came in and they argued my case. They didn't get me off of the they're still working on my case, by the way, at this moment. But they didn't get me off of the murder case. But they did got the first degree reduced to a second degree murder, which gave me a life sentence with a indeterminate term. So I can go before the parole board when I serve 80% of my term. Oh. And then there's another law that just came out during the same time that say if you are juvenile under 25, then you can go to a parole board hearing even before your minimum term is coming. So that's everything just pushed me right into the parole board racket. And yeah, so all that thing happened within a year or two time frame.
Right. Okay. Now, tell me when you started to hear about positive change within the prison system when you were there, and also explain what it is.
So when that happened, my custody points started to apply. This is the first time I ever went to a level 3. It's still a maximum security yard, but it have a lot more program. Okay. So I was transferred off of the level 4. I went to a level 3, which is Wasco State Prison at the time. When I got to Wasco, I'm with the mindset that I will take advantage of any program that is out there for me. And of course, I got in college. I got I started on my own meditation group. I was just doing everything. I was inspired at that time. And then we saw a flyer on the wall. It say dog program. And at that time, like, people think it's a joke because people do joke like that. They somehow they print flyer and just put them up. And everybody was, no, there's no way they're going to bring dog onto the yard, you know. And sure enough, in a couple of weeks later, we saw a volunteer coming onto the yard with dog. So everybody rushed to sign up for this program. I went and signed up for a program. And then we went through the interview process. And it's funny, and I remember this vividly because, I remember I was standing in front in the line. We were going into the chapel. Inside the chapel, there was a captain of the yard. The lead trainer at the time was Lisa Porter and Leah, another trainer. And they brought in a dog. So all the guys go in there and they come back out, and I'm like way back in the line. They all come out and they're like, I think I got the role. I think they picked me. And the guy like, why you think that? I go, because the dog came up to me and he hugged me and the dog liked me. So, you know, I'm sure I get the role. So in my mind, I was afraid of dog. And I don't know, like, I hear story about dog know that you're afraid of them. They won't come near you. Or they'll bite you, you know, and this is what's going on in my head. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to fail. Like, they're not going to pick me. I know they're not going to pick me. And so I went through this process with this fear. And so when I remember I went in, I sat there, and there's a dog right in front of me. And I trying to will myself to pet the dog, but I didn't. I didn't do it. I would just, maybe I would, I don't know what my hesitation was. But I answered their question. And one of their questions was, how do you deal with stress? How do you deal with confrontation without acting impulsively? And I told them, I deal with it by, you know, by anchoring myself, bringing my mind to my body, you know, pay attention to my breathing, using something physical to deter my mind from grabbing onto whatever it is that, you know, that stirred me at the moment. And I thought the interview went well, but then I walked out feeling I'm not going to be picked because I didn't touch the dog the whole time. I didn't even look at the dog. And sure enough, like 2 weeks later, they come back in and they read out the name of the guy.
How many names got read and how many do you think applied?
About 25 of us were selected out of the group. It was like 50 or 60 sign up. Okay. But they criteria before you even sign up. So you have to be disciplinary free for a whole year, which means you haven't gotten any trouble. And you cannot have any sexual related offense at all. Okay. But on that yard at that time, nobody there had that anyway. Yeah. And you have to write an essay on why you want to be in the program. And so there's other requirement. I don't remember exactly, but yeah. So 25 of us were selected. I was one of them. I was shocked. Like and so I later on, when I get to know the trainer, I go, why did you pick me? And they say they like my answer. They know I was afraid of dog, but that's not the problem. They go, you can overcome that.
Right. It's
how you deal with yourself, how you overcome your own, you know, how you overcome your own impulsiveness is different. Wow. That's what we care about.
And, explain to people listening, because this is so fascinating. What was the program? How many dogs to each person? And how did they describe it to you when you first, were you like, oh my God, I'm going to get a dog of my own now? Like, what? Tell us the details.
So what we were told, they brought in, I think, 8 dogs, and they paired three trainers per dog. So we have to group up. Oh, yeah, the other requirement to be in this program is you have to be willing to live with another race. So one of the big things in California, it's very racially segregated in prison. So when you come in, you either identify yourself as Black, White, Hispanic, or other, which means anybody, not Black, and I was an other. But that's something that, like, they group you in that and you live with those people.
And so they remove you from your actual cell and you live with someone else. And it's a 3-month program, right?
And so you have to sign and agree you want to live with another race, which go against the prison politic, because you cannot live with another race.
Did that deter some people from signing up for this because they thought they would get in trouble with other people and get into fights because of it or whatever?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. But you knew that this was cool enough that you wanted to try it.
Yes.
Okay. And so go ahead.
What they did was they pair you up with other race. At that time, they didn't have me live with another race, but my partner, people that I work with, are different races. But then again, I was the only Asian guy in the group.
Right.
So it wasn't really... But they say that they picked us because of our answer to the questionnaire, and that they picked the dog that had the energy most compatible with us.
Okay, so they did a good job of putting you, 2 other guys, and a dog that they really picked for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, that we have a guy, one of the guys, I don't remember his name, but he's tattooed over his face. He did like 20 years in solitary confinement. He was just like me, just came down, and they gave him a little chihuahua. Oh, so he thinking he's getting a like a pit bull, you know, like a tough looking dog. They gave him a chihuahua. And at the beginning, he's like, why are you giving me this? But then every day you see this guy, he's penned the chihuahua, he's feeding it. Like, it's really funny to watch. And the day that the dog left, he was just crying like a girl. He's like, oh. But I think it's a great program because it just allow a lot of us to tap into that, you know, that soft side that, you know, we just shield off for a very long time. And, you know, when you work with animal, then they're not just mental. They just receive you how you are treating them at the moment.
Right.
And if you are good to them, I'm really happy to see you. And so it just, it bring a lot of life to the guy in the program and even the yard, and the whole environment change when that program started there.
Oh, that's amazing. So you were there when the program first started. It hadn't been going on for a while. Okay. So, and then just the logistics quickly. So the animal lived in a crate somewhere else. Did the animal live with you guys? Where was the animal?
One of our cell. But in the day, so at night, when we have to go in ourselves and they lock the door, they stay in the crate in the front. But in the morning, the cell door is open all day. So they go in and out, they can roam around, and they can stay with us inside the cell, but the cell door is never closed. It have to be open.
Got it. And you take them for walks, and then you learn how to, the whole point of the program is you become trainers for the dogs, correct? Yeah. So they teach you how to teach the dog. And then ultimately, do you get a degree?
So at that time, the program was designed that we have 8 weeks to get the dog to pass the AKC CTC certification. So they have to pass that test. It's like a 10 obedient act that they have to do.
Like, give me an example. Was it like sit, stay, roll over? What is it?
So they have to be able to be greeted by stranger and not to be reactive.
I would fail that. And I have three dogs that I've had for years. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. You know, they should be able to walk to a crowd without being distracted. They should be able to sit with a stranger without having anxiety. They should, and all the other basic obedience, sit, stay, lay down.
Right. Well, some of those things are not easy. So they would work with you guys and teach you the tools of how to do this.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So tell me about the first dog you had. What kind of dog was it?
they gave me a Chihuahua nicknamed Prada. her name is Prada. She's here with me.
Oh my God.
Yeah. My family adopted her, but Prada was, like she was famous, she was on the news. It's a major hoarding case that they at that local place near the prison. She had litter, and then when the health department came in, they had to transport her with smitten because she
had behavioral problems.
Yeah, she'll bite anyone, and she don't trust people, and so they brought her in, and it's like, here's your dog, and she was in a crate. And basically, if you stick your hand in there, she'll bite you. And so I had to learn a lot of patience and just, you know, really sit there and wait. And I waited, and eventually she came out. She came out, she got on my lap, and then.
You were probably just as scared as she was.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
I think that's why they paired me up with her.
Wow. Yeah. And then you got to the point where you could pet her and she was like your everything,
She wouldn't leave me at all. Then she developed an attachment. So I would walk around and sometimes step on her because she just at my heel. Like I don't know where she's at. And that was my first dog.
And she pass all with your first dog, did she pass all the things?
They were amazed. They were like, the trainer came in, and not just her, I mean, all the dogs that came in, because they told her these dogs came in from Q shelter, high Q shelter. This is their last chance. If they can't pass this test, which, you know, when you want to adopt a dog have passed a CTC certification, it say a lot. And so the rate of these dogs can adopt is really high. So we would like, you know, we were giving her the responsibility of really transforming the dog and saving the dog life, like basically giving it life other than, you know, being put to sleep.
Yeah.
And so we were very dedicated. and at the end of the program, the trainer outside was just really amazed of what we are able to do. Like Prada, she'll go up to people, snip people. See, she'll tell you she don't like it if you try to reach out to her, but that's major for her.
Right.
She would, she starved for 4 days, not eating, just because of how, you know, how feral she is. She's like, no one come near her.
Wow. Yeah. And so how do you get most of the dogs adopted? Is there such a bond that gets built with these prisoners that they ask their families to take them and then hope that they're going to get out one day and be reunited with the dog?
Yeah, that was the case for me. And the other part was All the other dog got application early on in the program prior to then because, you know, she's a Chihuahua. And then all the other dog is a lot more, I guess, better looking. And so but when I learned that she, no one showed interest in her, it's a big convincing because my family don't, like I say, they have very different association with dog.
Yeah.
And I just told my mom, I go, you know, I trained this dog. Can you take her home? And they did, you know, and now it's their dog.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. And your mom loves her?
Yeah. She eat rice. She feel with chopstick.
Oh my God. I love that. I love that. Okay. So how many times, so then after the program's over, you reapply and you hope you get in the program or you keep doing it? How does it work?
So if you pass the first round, you become a mentor, and they'll select you and you become a mentor and you just stay in it as long as you can and help. So you become the trainer. You train the new guy.
So how many years do you think you did this until you found out you were leaving?
I was there for a year and then my custody point dropped. So I have to go to a level 2. And that time I didn't want it to go, but I know going to a level 2 will ensure a better chance for me to go home when I go to a parole board. Mm-hmm. And so I left there a year and then I parole a year after.
Wow. All right. Let's just for one more second, just tell me. So what was it like being in prison? You have no contact with anybody. You haven't pet a dog. Well, sounds like your whole life, but also the other men in prison and sometimes women have not had any contact, no empathy, no love. And it's almost the first time with that, but not only that, it's the first time that someone else is depending on you to change their life just as much as you're looking for someone to see you, you know, and change your life as well. So I think the bond that you create just must be outstanding. What was that like for, I mean, you were still somewhat of a kid. I mean, you know, and this was the bond that you were making and the things you were doing. How did that program change your life?
I think it's exactly what you say right now. I think for a lot of us, we came in as a kid. And so, you know, we have like a time capsule. When I a lot of time I'm still adjusting to the idea I'm in my 40 now. Mm-hmm. I still think I'm a teenager. I came in at 19. And there's a lot of things that lie dormant in us we don't allow to surface in that environment. And to have an animal, you know, a lot of those things come up very naturally. I can only speak for myself, but I never felt empowered until I'm able to, help another being. Like I didn't feel like I'm capable of that. And so it gave me a lot of self-worth because I didn't have any. I feel like I didn't have any. So when I'm starting working with this animal and connecting with this animal, all those emotion about who I am as a person, like what my role are, like what's life about, all those come surface. And you find meaning and purpose in that. And you notice all those other things that you find meaningful, mediocre stuff, you know, like, get affirmation from other people, how other people perceive you. It's insignificant to this idea of purpose of life that you are able to bless another being, give another being life. It's so empowering. It's like spiritual.
Yeah.
And at that time, I have to be honest, I didn't even think about going home or not. I just really enjoy this person I am today. And through that, it filtered to all the other thing that I do, other program I'm involved in. It just transformed me as a person.
Wow. So do they ultimately give like accreditation of some sort to you after you've done it so long so that when you did get out, I mean, I know you got into this for work. So did you have any sort of license that you came with?
They issue certificate from the program. But that's the program certificate.
Sure. Okay. All right. So fast forward, you find out that you are going to be paroled. Just tell me about that moment when you found that out.
So I transferred to CTF. This prison have a long corridor. And this, the reason I'm describing this, because it's so vivid to me. I just visited CTF a month ago. I walked down the same corridor, but I remember that corridor and I remember the room that say parole. So I remember what happened the day that I have seen a lot of people walk out of that room, just dejected. Like they came out with their head looking down and you know not to approach them, even to consult them, you shouldn't. I remember walking out of that room. Because when I would, it's a scary experience when you go in there because you have to sit in front of two person that don't know you but will ask you question that's gonna determine your life.
Sure. And how often do you go up for parole? Is it once every 4 years? Once every year?
It was my first time.
It was your first time. Okay.
Most people go, and I thought my first time I will be denied because of my behavior in prison. Mm-hmm. I went in there, and I want to share this. When I went in there, they were asking me the same thing you're asking me right now. You're like, okay, tell me about your childhood. Like that's the first thing they will ask you when you sit down, and you have to tell them in terms of how you gain this insight at who you are now. The clearer you tell them about your childhood, your mind's mental state at a time, the more insight they believe you have as an adult today.
Sure.
So that you can commit. And when I came in, I told the commissioner about my story. I told him about Vietnam and he just interrupted me right in the middle of it. And he said, why you think you deserve to be paroled today? Like just out of nowhere. And that caught me by surprise because nobody prepared me for that. They didn't say that this is the type of question they will ask.
Right.
And I have to ask the commissioner, can you repeat that, please, so that I can collect myself because it's a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, sure. Why do you think you deserve a second chance when you're a victim then? And I told commissioner, the person that was arrested, came into prison, does not deserve a second chance. He deserves to be in prison. But I remember I told him, I'm not that person anymore.
Wow. You're making me cry. Was he crying?
And that just changed the whole tone of the parole meeting. And I'm told this later by some people that they ask you that question just so they know how to approach you. Mm. And I think my answer, give them an assurance, this guy know what he know what this is about.
Right.
He have transformed himself enough. But yeah, that's, so I walked down the corridor different than many men that I see come out that door.
So do they tell you in that moment whether or not you've been approved?
Yeah, he gave me a very long description of how he feel like I shouldn't be. He say, if you are the right person, this law change, this law would create it for you. He say, I don't believe you need to be in prison anymore. And it's just, yeah, I still have the transcript. I keep reading over it. And he was a very difficult commissioner.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and did they ask you at all about the positive change and how that affected your life?
Yeah, they asked, you know, what kind of program you involved with, what your goal, what your 5-year goal, what your 1-year goal. And I told them, and I'm actually doing, I say I'm going to get my master degree. I didn't do that. I just jumped into work. So I stopped my education.
Well, most people don't have that. Don't worry.
But I pretty much fulfill all my short-term and long-term goal right now. So I'm.
Oh, my God. So, okay. So when they say, what are the words? They say, you've been granted parole?
Yeah. We find you suitable for parole.
And does that mean you're done? That means you're out? Or then you have to be approved by someone else?
or 120 day later, because they're going to have to, your decision will go to a subcommittee and they get a chance to review it and okay. they get a chance to deny it. And then it go to the governor office and the governor get a chance to deny it.
Okay. So it's not really 100%, but it's the first, it gets the ball rolling.
It's the first time I ever heard anything that's yeah. close to the word freedom for me.
Right. Yeah. So you waited 120 days and then you were told you were fully approved.
Yes.
Wow. And then you were let out like that?
Yeah. So I came out during COVID. It was 2020. And so it's kind of like abandoned.
The whole world had really changed when you were gone.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's like one of them horror movies. Like, you know, like you woke up and everybody was gone and you just keep abandoned car and abandoned building. It kind of felt like that.
Did anyone come to pick you up at the prison?
My brother did. My brother came and picked me up. And then he took me to a transitional home because by law, I have to stay in this place for 6 months.
Okay.
I can transition back to my home.
Wow. I know you told me you did a little bit of artwork. You painted animals, right, when you got out?
Yeah, so when I was in the transitional home, I reached out to John, which is one of the trainer in the Positive Change Program, and Zach. And so they're all very happy when they heard I'm out. They go, oh, yeah, Nyut is out. And so I correspond with them. And then Zach say, hey, you know what? You want to paint it? Because one of his, is it Milo? I'm not sure the name. I don't want to give it a name. It's not accurate. But one of the family, a pet just passed away. Mm-hmm. And his wife was pregnant with his second child. And he's like, I would like to have this as a gift for my wife. And I painted it, and I painted the dog and what's his first child holding the dog. Mm-hmm. And when he shared online, within one day, I have 6,000 followers on Instagram. My Instagram just went nut in one
day. And then did people start to actually buy the art from you?
Yeah, so I was painting for 6 months. I was actually painting the whole time, just painting for people, pet.
And I mean, I've interviewed some people that have gotten out of jail and or prison, and it's very hard for them to figure out how they're going to make money.
Yeah.
So this must have been very helpful to you.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what I think is so fascinating that after that you get out and you join Positive Change as a mentor, a trainer, and you go back, is it to the same prison every Tuesday to do this?
Yes, I was the prison that I go to right now. I was there for 2 years. Yes.
Wow. And so what did Zach hire you to work with him and be a trainer, or what is your actual job now? What do you do?
So I am a trainer. I work for Marley's Mud part time. Mm-hmm. So I am part of the Positive Change Program. So I go in there with other trainer and we help train the trainer inside, go through the same process that I was in. I think, there's another trainer that was formerly incarcerated like myself. Mm-hmm. I think we bring value to the program now, especially when we talk to the men inside and they learn about our past. And some of these guys I have known when I was inside. It's surreal when I see them. They're, hey! Like, it's just a crazy experience, but I know their heart. I know, like, you know, I know the day that we come in, I know the clothing that they wear is their best clothing. Although you only have, you know, you only have one color attire you have, but these attire are creased up. Like, these are special for visiting, for event, and they come and they wear that. The watch they are wearing, probably $20, $30 watch, but that in prison standard, that's a very quality watch. Like, the way they dress, why they show up the way they do, what's going on in their head when they come. I remember all that. And sometimes I just affirm that to them. I go, you know, have you gotten your canteen yet? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you see this part of connection and this light of hope that they have. And they tell you at the end, they go, you know, seeing you here just give me so much hope because I had life without. So sometimes I tell the guy, I go, you have a lifetime. You're going to go to a parole board in a couple of years. You don't have any excuses. I didn't have any chances at all. So, I mean, I would encourage you to like make meaning of every single day you have in here. And the goal is to go home.
Right.
It just so it's like a full circle.
Right. Right. I have to ask, is there any time when, you know, because I think this should be a program that happens in every city. I don't understand, or every state. I don't know why it doesn't. But I think fear would be that it's dangerous for the dogs, that it could be dangerous for the inmates. The inmates could fight over the dogs. There could be a fight between inmates, and then one of them wants to kill the dog to upset the inmate. I mean, does any of that stuff happen, or this is such a sacred program there that it's never happened?
I think the way the program design and the filter that it go through eliminate a lot of that. Of course, they're violent in prison, and there's still people that are struggling with mainly mental health. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people that have done extensive time or in there, they have done a lot of self-work. Mm-hmm. They have come to a place within themselves that I feel like they are more advanced than a lot of people out in society. These are the type of people, if you run them off in a freeway, and they would just take a breath and, you know, that's just part of life. A lot of people out here, they steal U-turn, they'll flip you up. Like, a lot of things that not, the environment force you to process a lot of these things. So mm-hmm. when these guys come to do interview, and I was fortunate to be one of the interviewer. It's just a surreal moment for me. I was a person that decide who can get in the program.
Wow.
And I was just sitting there and I look at the guy. And so I know who this guy is. And he don't need to tell me much about himself. All he need to tell me is where he lives, what kind of job he have, you know, what his favorite hobby is. And I can pretty estimate like 80% of his behavior, like what kind of motivation he have and who he is as a person. So we filter out these individual, and those individual that do come in a program, if not an elite of the group, they are passionate and they really care about these dogs. They want to change their life and they are grateful for the opportunity. So mm-hmm. that we have a lot of opportunity for abuse with the animal. I personally have not seen that during my time in the program.
I'm happy to hear that. And these animals are getting rehabilitated themselves. You guys are trying, and I think through Marley's Mutts, right? Are you guys trying to get them adopted outside of when they're done with the program? And for the most part, what happens to them if they don't get adopted? They get put into a rescue or a shelter until they do?
So Marley's Mutt is a rescue.
Okay,
so
got
it's a rescue. So they stay there if they don't get adopted.
And okay, it's a no-kill shelter, right? Yeah. I mean, okay. And you, what I think is fascinating about you is you were telling me on the phone before we did this interview that you really love the animals that have behavioral issues, because these are the ones that have been forgotten, given up on, and these are the ones you understand best. Just talk about that for a second, because it's so brilliant.
Yeah, I think in my experience working with dogs, a lot of dogs that are considered bad dog or behavior dog that they put down is just simply dog being themselves. You know, that is their instinctual nature. If they feel uncomfortable, they'll growl. For us to expect them to do otherwise, we're just imposing our will over them. And we say, yeah, this is the way things should be. And it is. I mean, they live among us, so they have to conform. And because I understand the challenge of conformity, like how hard it is for them to conform. Mm-hmm. When they conform, they kind of have to give up a part of themselves.
Right.
And so a lot of them are misunderstood, because I feel like if you make so much demand of the dog and you don't show them enough affection or guidance, you don't play like a maternal or a fraternal role with the dog in a way. Mm-hmm. A lot of those behavior is very superficial. They'll do it because our fear or our whatever reason it is. Mm-hmm. But true conformity or true transformation from the dog is they connected to you. They want to make you happy. Okay, if I'm going against my nature to make you happy, that's a big ass. That's a major ass. Like, you tell the dog not to use the restroom inside out. It's in their nature to go when they need to go. Yeah. You say, hold that and go outside. You know, So to have more empathy for the dog, to have more empathy for the type of dog that was struggling with understanding or social etiquette more.
Yeah.
I feel like that's my problem. I was really struggling with that. I didn't have the proper guidance. And a lot of it was just me telling myself what is right and what is wrong. I don't seek out for feedback from anyone. And so I love to work with those type of dogs, because once you see the transformation in them, you're like, wow, your potential is always there. Right. Just you need right communication and guidance.
I think people listening will be really interested to find out just where you are now in your personal life. Did you get married? Did you get real training so that you are, you have some sort of documents that you know how to train a dog? You know, just explain that a little bit. Oh, and also, is your father still alive? Have you spoken to him? That kind of thing.
Yeah. So fortunately, both my parents are alive and they're together. I didn't mention that shortly when they came over, they were divorced. So shortly when we came, they were living together. I got married. I have a two-step child. I own a dog training business. I have, so when I came home, I worked for one of the trainers that trained me. I worked for him for a year. I worked at a facility called LA K9. And I went to a lot of different workshops. I don't have any formal education, but I'm a CGC evaluator. So what I taught the man in there, I can actually teach, basically have my client dog pass this test and have AKC issue a certificate saying this dog passed this test.
Got it. Okay. So
I'm one of their evaluator. But I'm interested in going back to school and learn more about animal behavior. I know it's important to educate myself, but I have extensive experience working with dogs, and I'm happy where I'm at today.
Amazing. And has your father finally ever expressed some, sense that he is proud of who you've become now?
Yes. Yeah. Good. He don't say it, but I know it's there. Yeah.
Good. I love hearing that. God, your story is, there were so many times I had to not cry. I'm so proud of you. I wish you the best. I hope that, there are people that I'm talking to. I've been so impressed with what you and Zach and people like you have done. Zach is one of the founders of Marley's Mutts, and as you know, and Positive Change. But I think that this should be something that every state does. I think you should be going on tours of your story. Your story is phenomenal. I love that you speak to juveniles. I love that you're a mentor for people in prison. Keep doing what you're doing. You are unbelievable and you deserve the very best in life. So I just want you to know that. It's been my honor to have met you.
Thank you. It's an honor for me to meet you. When I first talked to you, I can sense the compassion you have for animal, and just as a compassionate person in general, I can sense that.
Thanks.
It's easy to talk to you.
Thank you. And you are, again, as I said at the beginning, very misunderstood, and it's made you a better person. And I think it's made you empathize with other people that are misunderstood and understand the power of second chances. So, it's like, congratulations on learning that lesson. It's been so hard for you, but, I guess you have to go through those steps to become who you are. And it also, it's a testament to your life could have gone down a completely different path and you could have become somebody totally different. If you didn't go to prison, you could be dead. You never know what could have happened to you. So I think this is probably the path you had to take to be the person that you are now. And so I hope you don't think that you spent so many years of your life wasted, because it was the path that you must have had to take to get to where you are now. It's the only way you can kind of make sense of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, if people want to read more about your story, hear more about Positive Change or Marley's Mutts, how could they get a hold of you or find out more about that?
I have a website called redemptiontale.llc.com. They can reach out to me on Instagram, and my Instagram, a lot of the posts is linked to Positive Change and Marley's Mutts. So they can reach out to us on Instagram.
Perfect. All right. Well, I hope we can stay in touch. I would love to see the kind of work you guys do. If I ever come out there, I want to come hang out with you guys. And if you ever come to Florida, you have an open invitation to come stay with me and train my unruly dogs who don't listen to anything I say. And, you know, but I love them so much, so I let them get away with it. But I always threaten them that I'm going to send them back to the pound, of course. You know, then I make them a steak dinner later that night. But all right. Thank you so much. And we will be in touch. Mwah. Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.